Chapter 88. The wooden midshipman goes to pieces. Honest Captain Cuttle, as the weeks flew over him in his fortified retreat, by no means abated any of his prudent provisions against surprise, because of the non-appearance of the enemy. The captain argued that his present security was too profound and wonderful to endure much longer. He knew that when the wind stood in a fair quarter, the weathercock was seldom nailed there, and he was too well acquainted with the determined and dauntless character of Mrs. McStinger to doubt that that heroic woman had devoted herself to the task of his discovery and capture. Trembling beneath the weight of these reasons, Captain Cuttle lived a very close and retired life, seldom stirring abroad until after dark, venturing even then only into the obscurest streets, never going forth at all on Sundays, and both within and without the walls of his retreat, avoiding bonnets, as if they were worn by raging lions. The captain never dreamed that in the event of his being pounced upon by Mrs. McStinger, in his walks, it would be possible to offer resistance. He felt that it could not be done. He saw himself, in his mind's eye, put meekly in a hackney coach, and carried off to his old lodgings. He foresaw that, once immured there, he was a lost man. His hat gone, Mrs. McStinger watchful of him day and night, reproaches heaped upon his head, before the infant family, himself the guilty object of suspicion and distrust, an ogre in the children's eyes, and in their mothers a detected traitor. A violent perspiration, and a lowness of spirits, always came over the captain as this gloomy picture presented itself to his imagination. It generally did so previous to his stealing out of doors at night for air and exercise. Sensible of the risk he ran, the captain took leave of Rob, at those times, with the solemnity which became a man who might never return, exhorting him, in the event of his, the captain's, being lost sight of, for a time, to tread in the paths of virtue, and keep the brazen instruments well polished, but not to throw away a chance, and to secure to himself a means, in case of the worst, of holding communication with the external world. Captain Cuttle soon conceived the happy idea of teaching Rob the Grinder some secret signal, by which that adherent might make his presence and fidelity known to his commander, in the hour of adversity. After much cogitation, the captain decided in favor of instructing him to whistle the marine melody, "Oh cheerily, cheerily." Apostrophe, apostrophe, and Rob the Grinder attaining a point as near perfection in that accomplishment as a landsman could hope to reach, the captain impressed these mysterious instructions on his mind. "Now, my lad, stand by. If ever I'm took, apostrophe, took, captain." Apostrophe, apostrophe, interposed Rob, with his round eyes wide open. "Ah. Apostrophe, apostrophe," said Captain Cuttle darkly, "if ever I goes away, meaning to come back to supper, and don't come within hail again, 24 hours arter my loss, go you to Brig Plus and whistle that ear tune near my old moorings, not as if you was a meaning of it, you understand, but as if you drifted there, promiscuous. If I answer in that tune, you sheer off, my lad, and come back 24 hours arterwards. If I answer in another tune, do you stand off and on, and wait till I throw out further signals. Do you understand the mortars now?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "what am I to stand off and on of, captain?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, inquired Rob. "The horse road?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "here's a smart lad for you." Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried the captain, eyeing him sternly, "as don't know his own native alphabet. Go away a bit, and come back again alternately, understand that?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "yes, captain," apostrophe, said Rob. "Very good, my lad, then," apostrophe, said the captain, relenting. "Do it." Apostrophe, that he might do it the better, Captain Cuttle sometimes condescended, of an evening after the shop was shut, to rehearse this scene. retiring into the parlor for the purpose, as into the lodgings of a supposititious McStinger, and carefully observing the behavior of his ally, from the hole of espial he had cut in the wall. Rob the Grinder discharged himself of his duty with so much exactness and judgment, when thus put to the proof, that the captain presented him, at divers times, with 7 sixpences, in token of satisfaction, and gradually felt stealing over his spirit the resignation of a man who had made provision for the worst, and taken every reasonable precaution against an unrelenting fate. Nevertheless, the captain did not tempt ill fortune, by being a whit more venturesome than before. Though he considered it a point of good breeding in himself, as a general friend of the family, to attend Mr. Dombey's wedding of which he had heard from Mr. Perch, and to show that gentleman a pleasant and approving countenance from the gallery, he had repaired to the church in a hackney cabriolet with both windows up, and might have scrupled, even to make that venture, in his dread of Mrs. McStinger, but that the lady's attendance on the ministry of the Reverend Melchisedech rendered it peculiarly unlikely that she would be found in communion with the establishment. The captain got safe home again, and fell into the ordinary routine of his new life, without encountering any more direct alarm from the enemy than was suggested to him by the daily bonnets in the street. But other subjects began to lay heavy on the captain's mind. Walter's ship was still unheard of. No news came of Old Sol Gills. Florence did not even know of the old man's disappearance, and Captain Cuttle had not the heart to tell her. Indeed, the captain, as his own hopes of the generous, handsome, gallant-hearted youth, whom he had loved, according to his rough manner, from a child, began to fade, and faded more and more from day to day, shrunk with instinctive pain from the thought of exchanging a word with Florence. If he had had good news to carry to her, the honest captain would have braved the newly decorated house and splendid furniture, though these, connected with the lady he had seen at church, were awful to him, and made his way into her presence. With a dark horizon gathering around their common hopes, however, that darkened every hour, the captain almost felt as if he were a new misfortune and affliction to her, and was scarcely less afraid of a visit from Florence than from Mrs. McStinger herself. It was a chill dark autumn evening, and Captain Cuttle had ordered a fire to be kindled in the little back parlor, now more than ever like the cabin of a ship. The rain fell fast, and the wind blew hard, and straying out on the housetop by that stormy bedroom of his old friend, to take an observation of the weather, the captain's heart died within him, when he saw how wild and desolate it was. Not that he associated the weather of that time with poor Walter's destiny, or doubted that, if Providence had doomed him to be lost and shipwrecked, it was over, long ago, but that beneath an outward influence, quite distinct from the subject matter of his thoughts, the captain's spirits sank, and his hopes turned pale, as those of wiser men had often done before him, and will often do again. Captain Cuttle, addressing his face to the sharp wind and slanting rain, looked up at the heavy scud that was flying fast over the wilderness of housetops, and looked for something cheery there in vain. The prospect near at hand was no better. In sundry tea chests and other rough boxes at his feet, the pigeons of Rob the Grinder were cooing like so many dismal breezes getting up. A crazy weathercock of a midshipman, with a telescope at his eye, once visible from the street, but long bricked out, creaked and complained upon his rusty pivot as the shrill blast spun him round and round, and sported with him cruelly. Upon the captain's coarse blue vest the cold raindrops started like steel beads, and he could hardly maintain himself aslant against the stiff nor'wester that came pressing against him, importunate to topple him over the parapet and throw him on the pavement below. If there were any hope alive that evening, the captain thought, as he held his hat on, it certainly kept house and wasn't out of doors. So the captain, shaking his head in a despondent manner, went in to look for it. Captain Cuttle descended slowly to the little back parlor, and, seated in his accustomed chair, looked for it in the fire. But it was not there, though the fire was bright. He took out his tobacco box and pipe, and composing himself to smoke, looked for it in the red glow from the bowl, and in the wreaths of vapor that curled upward from his lips. But there was not so much as an atom of the rust of hope's anchor in either. He tried a glass of grog. But melancholy truth was at the bottom of that well, and he couldn't finish it. He made a turn or two in the shop, and looked for hope among the instruments. But they obstinately worked out reckonings for the missing ship, in spite of any opposition he could offer, that ended at the bottom of the lone sea. The wind still rushing, and the rain still pattering, against the closed shutters, the captain brought to before the wooden midshipman upon the counter, and thought, as he dried the little officer's uniform with his sleeve, how many years the midshipman had seen, during which few changes hardly any had transpired among his ship's company, how the changes had come all together, one day, as it might be, and of what a sweeping kind they web here was the little society of the back parlor broken up, and scattered far and wide. Here was no audience for Lovely Peg, even if there had been anybody to sing it, which there was not, for the captain was as morally certain that nobody but he could execute that ballad, he was that he had not the spirit, under existing circumstances, to attempt it. There was no bright face of Waller in the house. Here the captain transferred his sleeve for a moment from the midshipman's uniform to his own cheek. The familiar wig and buttons of Sol Gills were a vision of the past. Richard Whittington was knocked on the head, and every plan and project in connection with the midshipman lay drifting, without mast or rudder, on the waste of waters. As the captain, with a dejected face, stood revolving these thoughts, and polishing the midshipman, partly in the tenderness of old acquaintance, and partly in the absence of his mind, a knocking at the shop door communicated a frightful start to the frame of Rob the Grinder, seated on the counter, whose large eyes had been intently fixed on the captain's face, and who had been debating within himself, for the 500th time, whether the captain could have done a murder, that he had such an evil conscience, and was always running away. "What's that?" " said Captain Cuttle, softly. "Somebody's knuckles, Captain," answered Rob the Grinder. The captain, with an abashed and guilty air, immediately walked on tiptoe to the little parlor, and locked himself in. Rob, opening the door, would have parleyed with the visitor on the threshold, if the visitor had come in female guise. But the figure being of the male sex, and Rob's orders only applying to women, Rob held the door open, and allowed it to enter, which it did very quickly, glad to get out of the driving rain. "A job for Burgess and Company at any rate," said the visitor, looking over his shoulder compassionately at his own legs, which were very wet, and covered with splashes. "Oh, how do you, Mr. Gills?" The salutation was addressed to the captain, now emerging from the back parlor with a most transparent and utterly futile affectation of coming out by accidents. "Thankee," the gentleman went on to say in the same breath. "I'm very well indeed, myself. I'm much obliged to you. My name is Toots, Mr. Toots." The captain remembered to have seen this young gentleman at the wedding, and made him a bow. Mr. Toots replied with a chuckle, and being embarrassed, as he generally was, breathed hard, shook hands with the captain for a long time, and then falling on Rob the Grinder, in the absence of any other resource, shook hands with him in a most affectionate and cordial manner. "I say, I should like to speak a word to you, Mr. Gills, if you please," said Toots at length, with surprising presence of mind. "I say, Miss D. O. M. you know," the captain, with responsive gravity and mystery, immediately waved his hook towards the little parlor, whither Mr. Toots followed him. "Oh, I beg your pardon, though, apostrophe said Mr. Toots, looking up in the captain's face as he sat down in a chair by the fire, which the captain placed for him. You don't happen to know the chicken at all, do you, Mr. Gills? Apostrophe, apostrophe, the chicken? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said the captain. The game chicken, apostrophe, said Mr. Toots. The captain shaking his head, Mr. Toots explained, that the man alluded to was the celebrated public character who had covered himself and his country with glory in his contest with the nobby Shropshire One. But this piece of information did not appear to enlighten the captain very much. Because he's outside. That's all, apostrophe said Mr. Toots. But it's of no consequence. He won't get very wet, perhaps. Apostrophe, I can pass the word for him in a moment, apostrophe said the captain. Well, if you would have the goodness to let him sit in the shop with your young man, apostrophe chuckled Mr. Toots, I should be glad. Because, you know, he's easily offended, and the damp's rather bad for his stamina. I'll call him in, Mr. Gills. Apostrophe, with that, Mr. Toots repairing to the shop door, sent a peculiar whistle into the night, which produced a stoical gentleman in a shaggy white greatcoat and a flat-brimmed hat, with very short hair, a broken nose, and a considerable tract of bare and sterile country behind each ear. Sit down, chicken, apostrophe said Mr. Toots. The compliant chicken spat out some small pieces of straw on which he was regaling himself, and took in a fresh supply from a reserve he carried in his hand. There ain't no drain of nothing short handy, is there? Apostrophe, apostrophe said the chicken, generally. This here sluicing night is hard lines to a man as lives on his condition. Captain Cuttle proffered a glass of rum, which the chicken, throwing back his head, emptied into himself, as into a cask, after proposing the brief sentiment, towards us. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Toots and the captain returning then to the parlor, and taking their seats before the fire, Mr. Toots began. Mr. Gill's apostrophe, awast. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said the captain. My name's Cuttle. Apostrophe, Mr. Toots looked greatly disconcerted, while the captain proceeded gravely. Cap'n Cuttle is my name, and England is my nation, this here is my dwelling place, and blessed be creation job, apostrophe said the captain, as an index to his authority. Oh, I couldn't see Mr. Gills, could I? Apostrophe said Mr. Toots. Because apostrophe, if you could see Sol Gills, young gentleman, apostrophe said the captain, impressively, and laying his heavy hand on Mr. Toots' knee, old soul, mind you with your own eyes as you sit there you'd be welcomer to me, than a wind astern, to a ship becalmed. But you can't see Sol Gills. And why can't you see Sol Gills? Apostrophe said the captain, apprised by the face of Mr. Toots, that he was making a profound impression on that gentleman's mind. Because he's invisible. Apostrophe, Mr. Toots in his agitation was going to reply that it was of no consequence at all. But he corrected himself, and said, Lord bless me. Apostrophe, apostrophe, that there man, apostrophe said the captain, has left me in charge hereby. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.